This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. The Democratic National Committee's elections over this past weekend were hugely contentious, with progressive activists pushing the party to move left by urging the election of Representative Keith Ellison as chair. But members picked former Labour Secretary Thomas Perez instead, with Ellison as deputy chair. Mr. Donald Trump congratulated Perez on Twitter before snarkily adding, "I could not be happier for him or for the Republican Party." Trump addressed the annual Conservative Political Action Committee meeting for the first time as president last week, and during his address, he made it his focus once more to slam the American media as the, quote, enemy of the American people. And on Monday, the president addressed the National Governors Association, where he announced sharp increases to military spending and major cuts to other programs. My guest is Doug Henwood. He is a political economist and also host of Behind the News, heard on KPFA and other Pacifica stations nationwide. He's editor of the Left Business Observer and author of After the New Economy and My Turn, Hillary Clinton Targets the Presidency. Welcome to the program, Doug.
Thanks for having me.
First, let's talk about the Democrats before we get to the Republicans. So the Democrats with their DNC and the Republicans with CPAC, which is, you know, an interesting sort of proxy for the GOP now. With this DNC election, what do you think happened? Thomas Perez was first basically called the establishment candidate, but now we're seeing some people say, well, actually, he is really quite progressive.
Well, yes, they would say that, wouldn't they? I think they want to contain the damage. The support for Ellison, I think, was greater than the establishment anticipated. I believe Obama recruited Perez to run for the position, and he and Biden and other Democratic leaders worked the phones for the last several days, lining up the votes.
So Obama and Biden were the ones pushing for Thomas Perez?
Well, yes, I believe it was Perez who actually, Obama who urged him to run to head off the threat of Ellison. It was funny how Ellison came out of the gate with endorsements from the likes of Chuck Schumer, who is not particularly progressive. But then a lot of heavy hitters in the Democratic establishment got very nervous about his candidacy. And then Chaim Saban, who is a big Democratic contributor, gave a lot to Hillary's campaigns. And is also a big Zionist, got really alarmed and denounced him as an anti-Semite and an enemy of Israel. But also there's a lot of worry that he too much represented the Sanders wing of the party, that is the Social Democratic wing that has proven far larger and noisier than the Democratic leadership wants it to be. And I think they're worried that their dominance over the party is ebbing. Not that they've done a great job running the party. I mean, you know, during the presidential campaign, it was striking how often Democrats kept saying the Republican Party's in meltdown. They kept, you know, how many times do we see those images of dumpster fires attached to the Trump campaign and the Republican Party? And you know, now it's anything but. They control all branches of government. They control, what, 2/3 to 3/4 of the states. The Democratic Party is falling apart. The only place it's competitive is at the presidential level now and big city mayoralties. But aside from that, the Democratic Party is a fading thing. And yet they seem to be going full speed ahead with the same old, same old. It seems like they have a death wish.
So Thomas Perez's election, you see it as basically going in the same direction as the party has gone, and it doesn't really represent a change. And that same direction the party has gone in has led to it losing Congress and the presidency and state legislatures, governors' positions, by and large. The Republicans control the majority of governorships. So basically, the party seems to have learned nothing.
It seems that way to me. I really don't understand what they're thinking at this point. They don't really have much of a bench for national candidates. One of the reasons that Hillary was so initially unchallenged as a nominee was that they're not much competition. Now that the Democrats have lost so many governorships, they don't have, you know, being a governor is a good preparation for being president, but they don't have all the governors waiting in the wings. They've lost so many congressional seats, so many state legislatures. temperature seats. So not only is it a problem for the present, it's a problem for the future. The pipeline of talent is quite empty. The only exception to that is there seems to be a whole lot of young people who are moving in, not just young people, but a lot of people disproportionately young, given the Sanders appeal, moving in at the state and local level, moving in the way the Tea Party did, or actually even the conservative movement in general did several decades ago, to take over the party from the bottom up. That's very promising, but that's going to take a long time to work through. But at the level of the leadership, at the senior levels of the Democratic Party, they seem to have learned absolutely nothing from their defeat. They just want to blame, Putin. It's all Putin's fault.
Right.
And now we hear Perez talking about the need to investigate the rigged election, sounding not unlike Trump would have sounded had he lost. It's just remarkable to see the Democrats get sucked up into this paranoia.
So basically, their new campaign platform is choose us because the Republicans are in Putin's pocket, instead of choose us because we stand for something. Clinton's failing approach was choose me because I'm not Trump. And we saw how that basically played out. Does the election of Keith Ellison as deputy chair make any difference? And the fact that, people are pointing to Perez Ellison being the first brown-black leadership of the DNC?
Well, we'll see what they do. I think that was just a way to buy off Ellison's silence and to try to keep his loyalists in the party, because I think there's a real threat that some people may just give up in the Democratic Party at this point. It seems incorrigible, unreformable, ossified. I don't know what adjective you want to throw at it, but none of them are very pleasant. The thing just looks brain dead.
So let's talk about Trump's tweet congratulating Perez and the Republican Party. What does Trump know that the Democratic Party doesn't seem to?
Yeah, I was wondering who wrote that for him. It seemed kind of witty and almost subtle, which is not his style. I think he's got a point that choosing, who knows? People can change once they're in office. Who knows? He may not turn out to be the establishment figure that we expect he is. But I think what Trump was saying is that if they keep going for more of the same, then they're going to continue to lose and continue to shrink.
And in fact, he kept bringing up the fact that the Democratic Party treated Bernie Sanders and Sanders' candidacy with the same disdain that they now seem to be treating Keith Ellison's positioning in the DNC. And in many ways, what happened between Ellison and Perez at the DNC election was almost seen as a proxy for what happened between Sanders and Clinton during the primary last year. I'm not sure if really that was true, but the analogy does seem to be, this battle between the progressive wing and the centrist wing of the Democratic Party, right?
Oh, it certainly felt that way. Mm-hmm. Who knows what goes on? Nobody has smokes anymore, so there are no longer any smoke-filled rooms, but whatever, the herbal tea filled rooms now. Who knows what goes on in there? But it certainly looks like this was the establishment fighting to keep control of the party. It sort of reminds me of the labor movement. The labor movement keeps shrinking, but as long as their paychecks don't bounce, the leadership of the major unions don't really seem to care that they're falling into irrelevance and may disappear at current rates within, a few years, especially if the Republicans get through some sort of national right to work law. I don't see how the currently constituted labor movement can survive that. But they seem, they're buddying up to Trump. We saw Trumka and some of the building trades guys. If they build the pipeline and the wall with union labor, I think you'd see a whole bunch of unions just smile and applaud and go along.
Wow. Let's talk about the CPAC convention, the Conservative Political Action Committee's annual meeting that took place last week. And this is a really sort of interesting conference that plays out every year. And often the CPAC is seen as the sort of agenda setting organization. But in recent years, because they had attempted to try to push away the Trump faction of conservatives, this year they seem to return to it full force. Trump addressed the CPAC for the first time as president, but he wasn't there last year. From what you saw of CPAC, how do you view the embrace by conservatives of Trumpism within the party, when over the last year, many establishment Republicans were attempting to distance themselves, and rightly so.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes this idea that the Democrats were really big on this, that Trump is not an ordinary Republican, and he's not in a lot of ways. But on the other hand, he has a lot in common with the party and the nativism and the bigotry and all that stuff. You know, the party is shot through at that stuff. Trump is much more blunt about saying these things openly. The rest of the party is more likely to use code words and euphemisms and, you know, dog whistles and all those things to disguise their message. But this is one of the things about Trump that, you know, he's mostly like a 95% revolting character, but the 5% part of him is refreshing, is that he says things that in the open that no one else will say. And he makes, you know, it's what these psychoanalysts call the return of the repressed. He just brings it out there and shouts it. So I think, you know, the CPAC, the more establishment Republicans, want to keep that stuff under wraps and treat it discreetly, but he's the president. And so now that he has the power, he has the patronage, he has the money, and they want piece of the action. They're still uncomfortable about the extremes of his movement, if you want to call it that. They kicked out Richard Spencer, the neo-Nazi, and they kicked out rescinded their invitation to Milo Yiannopoulos, who, I don't know, he's not exactly a Nazi, but he's odious. But apparently too extravagantly right-wing for the taste of the CPAC leadership. But yeah, I just want to say that I was a conservative long, long ago. It was a youthful indiscretion. I was a youthful indiscretion early in my years in college, and it's kind of funny now. But it did give me an insight into how those people think. I think as a consequence, I try to take conservative thinking more seriously than perhaps other people on the left do, as an opponent. I find very little sympathetic in it, but you know, I do try to see what they're saying. And I mean, Reagan gave a speech to CPAC, I believe it was 1977 or so. And it was, for all of Reagan's many, many faults, he was attempting in that speech to think seriously about conservative politics, in the present time. All that, there was an intellectual seriousness to parts of the conservative movement in the 70s. That has completely disappeared. And now it's just this circus of hatred and foolishness and ignorance. And Trump fits right in with that model. So it's really funny to look, you know, back at the old conservative movement, the William F. Buckley conservatism, which was very bigoted, don't get me wrong. But it was always had these pretensions of being very high-cultured and very philosophically serious. They've just lost that, and now they've got this, you know, this vicious clown as their their leader and our president. My God, and it's really it's just a sad and sorry and revolting spectacle.
So you mentioned Yiannopoulos had his invitation rescinded only after it came to light that he basically has publicly supported pedophilia. But other than that, he would have been welcomed. Richard Spencer, the founder of the neo-Nazi group, whose name I won't mention, was someone who had attended to every CPAC meeting, but because he's now become a bit of a controversial figure, he was punched in the face at the presidential inauguration, he was kicked out because his crazy and extreme and Nazi politics have come to light. Trump just didn't attend last year because he was too controversial. In how many ways do you feel that the GOP and the group that calls itself CPAC have birthed the Yiannopouloses, the Richard Spencers, and the Donald Trumps, but when push comes to shove, don't want to take responsibility for birthing them, except when they're finally accepted into the halls of power like Trump has?
Yeah, well, you know, Spencer and Yiannopoulos, despite their fame, are really, you know, not that important politically. They have, you know, they're very symbolic and revolting, but, you know, they have a hardcore following, but it's not a mass movement. Trump is the president, has the power of the American state under him, behind him, whatever. And of course, so they can afford to kick out the not so powerful celebrities, but they have to flatter the big guy.
The emperor.
But, you know, it's also just what Trump has unleashed, regardless of what he does himself, what he's unleashed, it just seems like open season for Nazis and haters of all kinds. And they feel like, well, you know, anything, it's all in the name of Trump. Trump's election justifies whatever they want to do. So, you know, we see all this harassment of immigrants now, you know, the desecration of Jewish cemeteries and phone threats to Jewish community centers. You know, I expected this kind of thing against, Muslims and immigrants, but now there's this kind of real, you know, Nazi anti-Semitism is on the march too. Revolting stew of hatred that Trump has unleashed, and you know, CPAC and the Republican Party are in large part responsible for this stuff. They really, you know, this stuff is always present in American society. It has been forever, but they've given it a legitimacy and a platform that has just, you know, just unleashed horrifying things. And they've also unleashed a movement of opposition, or, you know, grandly calling itself the resistance with a capital R, which I hope isn't hijacked by mainstream Democrats. But so there is that very encouraging development. But on the other hand, this is just the darkest impulses in American politics now have just gone.
Yeah.
They feel like they've got free rein, and it's a terrifying thing. And the Republicans and CPAC really, you know, have a lot to blame for it.
And I'm glad you brought up the desecration at another Jewish cemetery. This happened in Philadelphia exactly a week after it happened at another Jewish cemetery in Missouri, where something like 100 gravestones were pushed over. Let's turn to what Trump had to say at CPAC. You know, he basically let loose at the media again. This is his new favorite war. And here are some highlights for you, Doug, and for our audience of Trump's speech at the Conservative Political Action Committee.
You know, if you remember my first major speech, sit down, everybody, come on. You know, the dishonest media, they'll say, he didn't get a standing ovation. You know why? No, you know why? Because everybody stood and nobody sat. I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony, fake. A few days ago, I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are. They are the enemy of the people. Because they have no sources. They just make them up when there are none. I would have come last year, but I was worried that I would be, at that time, too controversial. We wanted border security. We wanted very, very strong military. We wanted all of the things that we're going to get. And people considered that controversial, but you didn't consider it controversial. Let me state this as clearly as I can. We are going to keep radical Islamic terrorists the hell out of our country. We are getting the bad ones out. These are bad dudes. We're getting the bad ones out. People that shouldn't be, whether it's drugs or murder or other things. Basically, all I've done is keep my promise. The core conviction of our movement is that we are a nation that put and will put its own citizens first.
And that is a series of highlights from Trump's speech at the Conservative Political Action Committee meeting last week. And of course, what his main theme was, Doug, is that he made a bunch of promises that essentially are along the lines of what the Republican Party has long campaigned on. And he is very proud of the fact that he is starting to keep those promises. And in a way, he has a point. You know, everything that he stands for is what the Republican Party has itself put forward, fanned the flames of, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's certainly a part of the Republican Party that's more pro-immigrant. The business-friendly part of the party is very pro-immigrant, not out of reasons of, you know, cosmopolitanism or internationalism, but just for cheap wages. I mean, there's an awful lot that he stands for that is classic Republican dogma, cutting back domestic spending. He is preserving Social Security and Medicare, or aims to. because I think a lot of his voting base leans towards the older demographic. But the ramping up defense spending in that's right in line with what Republicans have wanted to do. And he promised he would do it, and he's trying to do it. Whether he gets it done is another question, because legislative process is very messy and takes a lot of time. There'll be a lot of fights, and who knows what will emerge from Congress, but it will be almost certainly vile. The hatred of the media, which of course is funny coming from Trump, given that he's a total creation of the media. This guy has used the media in New York City constantly. And I moved to New York City in 1979, which is about when Trump burst on the scene. He didn't really become a national figure till sometime afterwards. And he constantly using the gossip pages, he's on TV all the time. And the guy really didn't have a lot of money, but he used the media to somehow, promote the notion that he was a brilliant businessman and a really, really rich guy. And it's what got him loans to expand his real estate empire. He's not a bit of great businessman by any conventional measure, but he used the media to spread the myth that he was. And it's funny to see him now talking about the lying media. I guess he knows about the lying media because he used them to lie for him, to make him a rich and famous person.
Doug, on Monday morning, Trump announced sharp increases to military spending, something on the order of 10%, a $54 billion increase, as if we don't have enough of our tax money going to the military. And to pay for that, sharp cuts in other programs and agencies, even U.S. aid to foreign countries, which is actually a very small percentage of the budget. He has apparently decided to leave, so far, Social Security and Medicare alone, even though his Republican fellow Republican colleagues do want those tackled. What do you make of this vision for the budget?
Well, it's a horrifying one. I certainly want to see Social Security and Medicare protected, especially as I'm approaching the proper age bracket for that. But I really despise the generational warfare that goes on around these things. The idea that we're taking care of the elderly and the young are getting screwed. I think that's true. The young are getting screwed, but I would rather see that addressed by increasing spending on young people, providing a good single payer health system and free college tuition and all the kinds of things that Sanders ran on. A lot of the people who point to generational inequity are trying to, by the back door, whether they intend to or not, enable an attack on Social Security and Medicare, which would be a very bad thing. But these are conventional Republican priorities. I think he has. They've been dreaming of destroying any kind of environmental regulation forever. And now they look like they're going to get their way. The guy heading Pruitt at the head of the EPA is a bit of a determined foe of the agency.
And Bannon, Steve Bannon said at the CPAC convention that the intent of the Trump administration was to dismantle the administrative state, dismantle agencies, dismantle regulations, whether we're talking about the EPA or the Department of Education.
Yeah, he's an administrative state, which means all the regulations that actual professionals who know what they're doing would trouble the private sector with. It's, you said earlier that, he's been keeping his promises, and in some sense he is, but he also ran as an anti-establishment figure, anti-plutocratic figure. Mm. At times he ran against Goldman Sachs. He's got four alums of Goldman Sachs in his administration. It is a plutocrat's administration in every sense, and it's not just it's a certain kind of plutocrat. He loves these private equity guys. They're not entrepreneurs who build great new technologies in the sense that capitalist myth makers like to present themselves. No, it's these financial operators who loot existing assets for their own benefit. Trump himself ran a lot of his businesses that way. It seems like very much a plutocracy of decay, and it's none of the optimism. The American optimism has been an annoying thing for many, many years, but it's a remarkable change to see this guy snarling with no vision for the future, with none of this happy talk about the future. It's all a very backward-looking, nostalgic, tinged with resentment vision. And it's a remarkable departure for American history.
Well, Doug, we live in interesting times indeed. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Anytime.
Doug Henwood is a political economist, editor of the Left Business Observer, host of Behind the News, heard on KPFA, Pacifica Radio, and other affiliates with Pacifica. He's also the author of After the New Economy and My Turn, Hillary Clinton Targets the Presidency. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can find our interviews online at risingupwithsonali.com and also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.